We'll now move on to the first plenary of today. And I would like to introduce the chair of the first plenary, Richard Yee. Richard is a member of the 2004 ERM Organising Committee, and he's also a member of the General Insurance Practice Committee and a director at Ernst & Young. Can you please welcome Richard to the lectern?
Thanks, Josh. Good morning, everyone. A recent headline in the financial press was Chase Growth, Corporate Australia Told. If I could just quote some of the points in that article. Challenger Chief Executive Brian Benari has called on Australian companies to chase growth more aggressively, echoing Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens' concerns that business is hooked on dividend payments at the expense of fueling economic growth. Brian says, I think it's incumbent on Corporate Australia to make sure they're committed to growth, to entrepreneurialism. I think it is up to Corporate Australia to get out there and strike a blow. We need to be thinking about taking our businesses offshore. We need to be innovating, thinking about productivity. Challenger's CEO Brian Benari's comments could equally be applied across all financial institutions. Why even BHP, Rio Tinto, chasing growth above all other priorities. They're really gunning for growth at the moment. For the past 5 years, since 2008, ERM has been about managing the downside risk. As part of the organising committee this year, we turned that on its head and said, how is ERM used to capture the upside? Particularly now in a low interest rate environment, it's all about growth. Today we've got a very special panel represented by four institutions. We've got a life insurer in Tau, Scott McKenzie, a health insurer, Bupa, Antonio Ibarra, a wealth and life company with a very long history, AMP, Mike Thornton, and a wealth life institution at a younger stage of development, Challenger, we've got Richard Willis. Before we begin, I've got just a little bit of housekeeping to go through. We know that there's ERM Connect for feedback, text messages through the SMS, and also we have Tweet, if anyone's into Twitter, the hashtag 2014ERM. I'd really encourage everyone to get involved in the session, come forward with your questions, and you know, don't be shy. I'd like to introduce Scott McKenzie now. Scott's bio, he joined TAL in April 2014, following an extensive career in financial services in the US, Latin America and Canada. Scott was most recently CEO and founder of a risk consulting firm based in Atlanta, where he lived and practiced before taking up the role at TAL. Previous to this, he worked for 16 years in a variety of senior executive roles for ING in the US, including as Chief Risk Officer and Chief Financial Officer for ING Latin America. He was also ING America's Head of Corporate Planning and Secretariat, and has been in life product management in a senior leadership role. Prior to joining IAG, Scott was a consulting actuary with Milliman in the US. Please welcome Scott to the podium.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here at the Institute for my first meeting. I really enjoyed the words from Howard earlier. Is that better? I'm not sure which mic is on. Okay. Sorry, from Howard. It really hit home with some of his comments around how we want to take risk management forward. And certainly being a part of this panel where we're talking about the upside of risk in practice is really how I've been thinking about risk over time, coming from various aspects within the business. So what I wanted to talk about was we're going to be talking about the challenge, how challenge as risk officers can really help on the upside. So I think one of the first steps that we have to overcome as risk professionals is the stigma of the word risk as being a four-letter word. The traditional aspect of risk is that it's really looking at the downside, protecting that tail. But really, risk is variance from expected, and that includes the upside, which is the opportunity. And so that's what our panel is talking about today. So all of us, probably all of us in this room is either actuaries or risk officers are really part of the group of chief challenge officers. Directors as well included in that, and I would also include auditors. And as challenge officers, we have the opportunity to influence the company. So capturing the upside of risk, what we want to be doing is really increasing the likelihood of better outcomes, which will increase the value of the organization. And this can be achieved by being able to identify the what to challenge and the when to challenge. So first answering the question of what to challenge, it's important to maximize the resources that we have within in the risk teams that we have. You don't have unlimited resources, so you have to take the right opportunities to challenge in the right places. And likewise, you can't be getting in the way of everything or talking about everything, challenging everything, because that'll become bureaucratic and you'll become less business friendly, kind of what Howard was talking about. So what we want to do is, again, talking about the process of setting up the right framework from which to challenge. So we want to be challenging at the risk setting stage, which is the business strategy. We have to do that within the risk appetite. So once the framework has been established, we then have to figure out, what times to challenge, where to challenge, when to challenge, and figure out how to get beyond just looking at tolerances and ranges, because it's not just about those, but challenging within sort of the playing field that we operate in. Again, traditionally, risk management within risk appetite is talking about those boundaries, the tolerances, the limits. And so it's not just about going beyond those limits, but how do we operate within that area? So traditionally, we've thought about strategies as usually accompanied with a financial plan, and it's often a set-and-forget exercise. So it's a singular view of the potential future period, but as we all know, stuff happens along that execution journey, and so we have to be prepared for that. So those tolerances help set those limits, but they really are focusing on those extremes, the tail events. So what we want to do is figure out when to challenge. So key to improving the when is to think different. So as risk professionals, we don't want to rely on just some single truth. It's not just an economic capital model that tells us something. We have to think about different ways of finding perspectives to talk to the business. So we have the bottom-up, the historical experience that we're used to using as actuaries, but we also have top-down, sideways. You have to think about the Australian market, of course, but think outside the Australian market. Think globally. Think other industries, other disciplines. It's important not to just have one perspective on something when we're talking about challenging the risk. So again, timing that challenge for the greatest effect. The limits and tolerances are setting boundaries, but they really don't inform the decision-making in the allowable playing field that we operate in. So in order to really truly improve the value creation in an organization, the earlier that an opportunity is identified, the earlier you can challenge and make some kind of a decision around that that will create value and improve your ultimate outcome. So rising above the competition. To summarize, risk is, it's more than just a process or a document. As risk professionals and ERM in particular, we can perceive the landscape ahead to uncover those opportunities. So again, as Howard had mentioned, you have to really take that balcony view and see what's going on in the organization to be able to identify those places that you can actually work with the business to improve those potential outcomes. And as chief challenge officers, of course, we want to capture that upside in risk. It's about partnering with the business and not just using risk language, but using business language. We have to be able to communicate well and make the risk challenge and the way we operate as a business part of the DNA. By doing so, that really will elevate that debate that we have with the business above just sort of the details that we could sometimes get mired in. So it's not just about process and documentation. The better challenge can lead us to working within those boundaries in a better way. We're, again, not just looking at those extremes, but how to actually operate more effectively in those within the paradigms that we have, and better challenge those. You know, we may not get the perfect outcome, the perfect timing, but we'll have a much better likelihood of sort of reaching out on that sort of mythical, efficient frontier on that decision-making. And the further out we can get there, the better we'll optimize our ability to create value. And so the opportunities, I'd say I'd cover risk upside, but it's really to exploit the risk upside. So by doing so, you can really create a competitive advantage. So we have just very brief comments here, and we'll have questions, I think, at the end. So I'll pass it back.
Thank you. Thank you. Please welcome Antonio.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, I'll just go very quickly through. I just want to talk a little bit about Bupa. A lot of you know Bupa as a health diabetic. Can you hear me back there? Excellent. Okay, and what it is we do besides being a health fund, what we do globally. And then I'm just going to talk about three key elements that I think are fundamental in our organization in order for us to be able to capture the upside risk. It's very interesting, but you'll notice there'll be some common themes with the previous speakers. It's good to see that there's some consistency there. So, Bupa, over 60 years experience, created in 1947 in the UK, earlier in Australia. We're a global healthcare company, and that's our key focus. We're quite interesting. We're a provident association, so we don't have shareholders. We reinvest all our profits into the organization. We're international scale, 22 million customers. We operate in 190 countries. We employ more than 70,000 people across the world, from the US to Australia, New Zealand. Recently done an acquisition in Chile, so we've got a strong sort of presence in Latin America and really across the globe. Our business model, we're into funding. We fund healthcare for customers in 190 countries. We have provision business as well, so we have aged care homes. We have hospitals across the world. And we're also involved in engaging people in managing their health. So getting at the early stage of people's healthcare requirements, whether they're chronic conditions, whatever those may be, and take them across that journey. And sorry, I'm going to just sort of speed through these because we want to get to the key theme and not the corporate pitch. So in Australia and New Zealand, what do we do? Health insurance. We're currently the largest healthcare private healthcare fund here, not for much longer, I believe, with the Medibank IPO. We have care services in both Australia and New Zealand. So we have care homes, retirement villages, and some hospitals. So here we have 4.9 million customers and 14,500 employees. We're split into, we have a health services unit that has Dental Core, which is the largest private health provider of dental services. Bupa Medical Services for visas, that is for people living in the country that need to go through their residence application. They have to go through a number of sort of medical tests and so on. We provide the centers that do that. Bupa Optical, I'm sure you've seen those on the street. We have some sort of retail optical centers. And Bupa Health Dialogue, which is a phone-based service that helps people sort of manage their health health issues. So, going now to the sort of more important bit of our conversation. I thought I'd go through the three elements that I think are fundamental for us to be able to capture the upside. So, having a clear risk strategy that's aligned to the business model with clear guiding principles and a clearly articulated, understood, and implemented risk appetite. The second point is robust governance structures with clearly defined roles and responsibilities within a three lines of defense framework, and a recurring theme, risk culture across the organization. It's everyone's responsibility in the organization, and how we cascade that. So If we go to the first one, risk strategy aligned to the business strategy. So we, our business strategy is one of extraordinary growth, living Bupa's purpose of longer, healthier, happier lives, embracing customers, aligning with partners, and engaging risk. And our risk strategy statement is about fully informed risk-taking and effective risk control that supports the delivery of the business strategy. So it seems pretty obvious, but we seek risk. We're out there looking for risk. It's just important that we understand in what areas we seek risk, and that's part of that risk appetite. So we have a number of sort of key principles where you know, our risk management framework is fully aligned with our business strategy. The board has accountability for it. The framework is communicated to senior management, staff, and outsourced functions, and is understood. Three lines of defense fully embedded. Risk appetite expressed qualitatively and quantitatively. And that is challenging. We've had quite a few challenges in being able to express appetite in that way. And then your standards, risks are identified, measured, managed, monitored, and reported on an individual and aggregate basis. And we have an effective control framework. So I'm not going to spend too much time on three lines of defense. I think this is a well-known subject and what those roles and responsibilities are. But it's a fundamental part of governance that we need in place with clear roles and responsibilities. That is what it looks in practice for us. The diagram sort of reflects our risk management framework and three lines of defense framework. And I think one of the things that was mentioned before was about the partnership between the business and risk management. So line one and line two. And we've done quite a bit of work on that. We have a partnership model where you have clearly defined roles and responsibilities for the first line, clearly defined roles and responsibilities for the second line, and then a whole area where we work in partnership without losing the independence of the line. So how do we support the first line as risk managers? How do we engage with that first line? So the second line is responsible for developing risk management frameworks. The first line is responsible for implementing them, and so on. So that's sort of a subject pretty close to my heart. Then the last point is risk culture in the organization. And I think we've already heard some from the top, CEO, board engagement. Role modeling and behaviors by senior management and managers in general in the organization. We hear a lot about culture. Sometimes there's sort of lip service paid to it, but we don't see the actual behaviors and modeling of those. So it's role modeling of those. A clear and well-communicated strategy, providing the right training at all levels in the organization. Performance management, ensuring that bad or poor risk practices are not accepted. Objectives linked to risk management. A culture of rapid escalation of threats and concerns. A culture where you can speak openly of risk and you're not worried about being chastised for it. High standards of analytical rigor and information sharing across the organization for us globally. So issues that may happen in one territory could have a could also occur in another one. So what can we learn from each other and so on, being quick. And then the last one is it's everyone's responsibility. Absolutely everyone in the organization is a risk manager. And that's, for me, summarizes that culture piece. And again, I think we have Q&As later, so I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you very much.
I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Mike Thornton. He's the Group Chief Risk Officer at AMP. He has over 20 years' experience in life and wealth management. Mike held a number of senior finance roles in the UK before migrating to Australia in 2000, where he joined AXA Asia Pacific in Melbourne, where he was Group Chief Actuary and Group Chief Risk Officer, where he successfully steered AXA through the GFC. Please welcome Mike.
Good morning. Over the next 10 minutes, I'm going to talk about two of the items that Howard touched on, risk culture and the transformations that are occurring across risk management teams, not just here in Australia, but also overseas. Why am I going to be talking about these two subjects? Because I believe you need a really sound risk culture if you're going to consistently and sustainably capture the upside. Now, I can sense the energy in the room waning a little bit, so this is going to be an interactive session. So buckle up, hold on to your hats, and let's get the energy moving. So, look, let's start by seeing if our arms are working. I want everybody to see if they can use their right arms. And let's put our arms up in the air. How many? That's a pathetic attempt. That's better. That's a little bit better. Okay, I've got some arms waving. That's excellent. It's good to see everybody being present and proactive, and I'm just going to put that to the test for a moment. So I want to explore whether your risk team is constraining the business and slowing it down, or whether it's being present and proactive and helping you capture the upside. So give me a show of hands if you think your risk team might be constraining your business. Again, let's see if there are any right hands in the room. That's a relatively small proportion of those who can use their right arms. Let's have another try. Do you think your risk management team could do a better job at supporting business growth? Again, let's see another show of hands. Okay, that's a reasonably healthy proportion. Probably about 50% of people who can use their right arms, and that's not everybody, think that risk management teams can and should be doing a better job. I certainly share that view, and I'd like to see risk management teams be much more proactive and commercial. And I think there are three keys to success here. So we've got three very simple messages. Firstly, over-invest in risk culture and make sure you get that right across your business. Secondly, involve risk management people in your leadership teams. And thirdly, demand that your risk management teams step up and add more value. Now, I'll explore each of these items in turn. But to summarise, risk management needs to be embedded in your corporate DNA. It needs to be intertwined in the very fabric of the organisation as a core component of your strategy, in key decision-making processes, and in the way that people behave day to day. Done well, it will work so well you don't even know it's there. Apple made the iPhone so intuitive that you instinctively know how to use it. It fits into the palm of your hand, it operates as you expect, and you just find ways of making it work for you. And risk management should be just the same, and I think that can be achieved in large measure by making sure you've got a healthy, consistent, and well-understood risk culture. And it should just work. Now, I know this isn't easy. It's a journey that pretty much everybody in the room will be on, but we all know it's important. And when I speak to the leadership teams, boards, regulators, it's a key priority for them, one that needs to be front of mind and a focus for us. Done well, business leaders will instinctively and intuitively manage risks in their business, and they'll do that in a way that's consistent and aligned with the whole organisation. It'll increase the level of consistency in risk-taking across organisations, empower business leaders to act, reduce the input from risk teams, and as a result, reduce some of the angst and costs in the system. And I believe this is key to consistently capturing the upside, as well as providing opportunities to significantly enhance the allocation of capital and resources. I now move on to talking about risk transformations. and the rebranding that Howard talked about that's occurring, not just here in Australia, but also overseas. In this period of lower growth, and following the financial crisis, businesses are critically reviewing their cost bases. And risk management teams are doing just the same, and we're all being challenged to reduce our costs and add more value. And that means that teams are needing to go higher up the value chain and increasingly get out of the detail. And that, of course, is a challenge, but it's feasible if you've also got a focus on building a healthy risk culture. Accordingly, I see risk management teams really sharpening their focus on the three lines of defence, stepping out the detail, and acting more as business partners working in close collaboration with leadership teams. That's the increased engagement that Howard and a couple of speakers before me have mentioned. In financial services, CROs are now being required by regulators, and these need to report to the CEO. So, the profile of these roles is increasing all of the time, and CROs need to earn their seat at the leadership team table. That can't be expected. It needs to be earned. Same applies to the direct reports of CROs. If they're going to support business leaders, they too need to be embedded in the business and at the table when strategic objectives, issues and decisions are being discussed. That way they can constructively challenge in real time without the impost of separate processes and costs. By sitting at leadership team tables, risk managers can round out their knowledge of the business, see more of the commercial realities, and a better place to influence the culture, the thinking, and ultimately the business outcomes. In addition, it encourages risk teams to focus on the important things that business leaders are concerned about. Now that doesn't mean that the detail doesn't get covered. It does, but if you've got a sound risk culture, those things will be much easier to grapple with in collaboration with the first line of defence. So transformation and risk culture need to go hand in hand if you want to do more with less. Similarly, the best way to capture the upside is to empower business leaders, to have a culture that allows them to act, and at the same time to make sure your risk managers are commercial, are influential, and are sitting at the leadership team tables up and down the business. Summarise, just three key messages. Overinvest in risk culture, involve risk management people in your leadership teams, demand that your risk management teams step up and add more value. Any thanks for your time.
We've got our last panellist, but not least, Richard Willis. Richard joined Challenger in November 2003 and in January 2011 was appointed to the role of Chief Risk Officer, with overall executive responsibility for the risk division and Challenger's enterprise risk management. He chairs the executive risk management and life and asset liability committees. Prior to taking on his current role, Mr. Willis was head of treasury and risk, where he was responsible for overseeing Challenger's risk and treasury functions. Please welcome Richard.
Thank you. I guess this is quite a timely topic. You probably, you know, with sort of some of Brian's comments that were read out from the press. The theme of Challenger's results presentation in August was moving up a gear on the lead sort of slide, and further into the presentations, moving up a gear to capture growth. So I think that's sort of in keeping with this seminar. And that's sort of reflected, you know, the current growth we've seen in the business. Although I did see a headline last week saying that there was a 65% chance of a global recession in 2015, so we may not have too much more time to capture some of this upside. So how does the ERM framework change, or how is it different to capture the upside? And I think I agree with you know, some of the comments that Howard said. I don't think the components sort of change at all. It's how it is, how it's implemented in many ways. It's the, and it really starts with the strategic planning. I think when a business wants to move into a new direction or, you know, capture the upside with new strategic initiatives, they really need to sort of fill out, you know, what sort of risk they want to take to do that and how they're going to what sort of returns they want to get for that risk. And they need to be very clear about that. I think the business really needs to own that. Clearly, you know, the risk function sort of challenges that. But the risk, the business needs to actually own the initiative and the risk they want to take to do that. An example from Challenger is, as some of you probably know, we focus on retirement incomes. You know, our key product, core product, is lifetime and term annuities. And that leads to our asset risk charge is the dominant sort of risk within the business. More recently, we've been pursuing taking on more life risk as a means of diversifying earnings and enhancing return on equity, given that sort of dominance of the asset risk charge in our sort of prudential capital requirements. And so how have we been doing that? Well, it has been over a couple of years. It has been as part of the board's strategic planning offsites that, you know, the business has been pitching how we would do that and, you know, what sort of capital and what sort of risk we would take to undertake that sort of strategy. And so that's been over, it's a number of cycles to do that. And it's only more recently that we've been actually increasing that amount of risk on the books. You know, initially, each time a deal was brought up, it was sort of taken to the board on a deal-by-deal basis. And that's really to bring them along the journey and so that, you know, they can see that it's within their sort of appetite and the way that the business is taking on that risk. I think then the rest of the ARM sort of flows from that. It's, you know, you need to establish a policies and limits around that, ways you're going to take on that risk, you know, what are the underwriting requirements and processes around that, and then, you know, what sort of limits around various types of risk. You need to then develop the reporting framework to include the new risks and how they're reported through the various sort of governance framework. Assess the, you know, it's an ongoing thing is assessing the extra resources or different resources and expertise needed within the firm to manage that. Down the track, you need to look at, you know, how that sort of fits into the stress testing and scenario analysis planning. If, you know, as that risk sort of develops, where it fits into that sort of scheme. I think another key thing, almost along the lines of Mike's sort of presentation, is that how does growth generally affect the risk culture? Now, I think, you know, in the example I've just given, it's not a major change in many ways, but if in a growing in a certain initiative, you're hiring a lot of people or hiring a lot of people to a new activity, or particularly if it's a merger and acquisition sort of type growth strategy, then I think you've got to be very cognizant of how that's going to affect your risk culture. When you bring a whole lot of new people in, that will sort of change the culture, and I think that's a key thing. I think we hear a lot of tone from the top around risk culture, and I think that's important. I think the sort of thing I've heard is that tone from the top is necessary but not sufficient, and I think that's true. I think a lot of the research has shown that risk culture is really driven by your immediate manager, and I think that is the hard part of risk culture. It's not too hard to work out, you know, around the board, around the senior exec team, what the culture and what the attitude is like. It's very hard to do thing, get right down into the organisation and assess how it's working from there. And I think that's something that can change quite quickly if you bring in a new business or there's a merger and acquisition opportunity. So I think I'll probably leave it from there, and then we're moving to we'll sit down in the comfy chairs.
Thanks, Richard. I could welcome the panellists to the chairs, which is not a stage, but I think we'll get the camera will show your faces on the screen as well. So how about we go in reverse order that you spoke in? If I could just ask Richard the first question. How does ERM interact with strategy and planning?
I suppose it's on, yeah. I think it's as I was saying, I think that is key, is that the new strategy and the planning has to have risk up front. I don't think you can have the strategy and planning, you know, whether it's sort of revenue targets or whatever the business plan has been put up, and then after that's all done and approved, then have the risk sort of come in and sort of say, well, is that in appetite or what is the appetite around that and how's that going to be implemented? If it is that sort of back-end filter, then I think you've got it wrong. I think the business certainly needs to own the risk they're taking for their strategies up front. And if they don't, then I think their KPIs are wrong. So if the business sort of, when putting the strategy and the initiatives up, has the risk sort of appetite and the the risks they're going to take and how they're going to manage those as part of the getting the approval for that strategy and that initiative, then I think the rest of it flows from there.
Do you find being involved up front and also being the risk manager sort of approving steps along the way, is there any conflicts in that situation?
I think there can be, but as I said, I think the business needs to own it and the risk challenges. So I don't, it's not sort of, certainly not my role as part of the proposal to go up to then sort of overlay what risk they should take and the appetite around that. That needs to be, the business needs to own that as part of it and then convince the board that sort of makes sense and that is within the board's sort of appetite to do that. So I don't see that is actually a conflict. It is, I think as Tanya said, it is a bit of that sort of working together sort of part of it, but there is still a different segregation of the lines.
Sure. Thanks, Rich. Mike, I've got a double-barreled question for you. You briefly mentioned the link between risk culture and the efficient allocation of capital. Can you expand on that a little, please? And the second gun to the question is anybody really making traction in risk culture? It's a difficult issue.
Yeah, let's take the first question first.
Yep.
So let's think about risk management in two ways for a moment. The first way sort of related to the diligence with which risk appetite is used in decision making. So is risk management embedded in decision making process? Is it understood? Is it intuitive? And does it just automatically occur? Is it embedded in the decision making process? Now clearly, when risk management operates like that, it's more cost effective. And the business can move more rapidly than having a separate process that needs to look at business decisions after the event, so to speak. Think about risk management another way in helping to make sure that businesses deploy their limited resources on the right things. Do the right risks get priorities? Do the right risks get acted upon and managed? Or is it a bit of a scattergun approach where some big risks don't get managed and investments are spent managing the detail on less important issues? So I think in both cases, if you've got a really well embedded risk management framework and a really healthy risk culture, reduces a lot of angst and just makes sure that the business focuses on the important things.
Okay.
Second question on culture.
Traction in risk culture.
Look, I think... I mean, it's clearly a difficult subject, and you can't change the risk culture quickly. That said, I think we've got to be optimistic, and we've got to be in for the long haul. I think we've got to think that if we can influence the tone at the top, if we can embed risk management in decision making processes, if we can increase the capability of our teams and give them more engagement skills, I think we've got to be optimistic about being able to influence the culture over time. Everybody's working on it, everybody's on the journey, everybody's probably at the beginning, but I think we've got to be optimistic about our ability to make progress.
I'll just defer this question for a bit later, but one of the ones coming through in the SMS is how do you measure risk culture? So I'll just park that for a second. Antonio, why in your view is governance a key enabler to capture the upside?
I think I could turn it around on his head. Without good risk governance, you can't have good risk management. So without the right governance structures in place, without clearly allocated roles and responsibilities and so on, risk management invariably fails. So for me as a risk professional, the thinking has always been that governance structures, clearly defined roles and responsibilities, are fundamental for successful risk management.
I was recently at a client which had we all talked about silos today, and then you've got to have the balcony view of risk as well. And one of the issues with that client was no one really looked across the silos in their structure and governance. Is that something that you could comment on?
Yes, I think and there was mention about the silos previously by some of the other panelists and so on, and how this you had sort of silo-based risk management. So you had your credit risk guys doing a piece of work, and then your market risk doing it, and not talking to each other.
Yeah, the situation I had was where someone reported to Singapore and someone reports to Switzerland, and then they were sitting next to each other but didn't talk, for example.
Yes, we sometimes have those challenges with our corporate center structures when they you have people sitting next to each other and not talking to each other and so on. We try to have in the organization we have a global senior risk leadership that is responsible for cascading all sort of the risk activity that's happening and facilitating that kind of communication. And what we do not do is have the silos created of different for different risk categories, where the risk people don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. So I think that works, but you know there will always be some small communication glitches there.
Yeah, thanks for that, Antonio. Scott, I've got two questions here. To accomplish the upside in risk, you need to be part of the business discussion. In your experience, have you encountered much pushback in being involved in that process? The second part of it is there any tips for any actors in the crowd who aspire to be a CRO?
Okay, thank you. Well, interestingly, the being a part of the discussion, at least in the financial services in Australia here, was helped with the regulator and CPS 220 saying you need to be there, that position exists, but that doesn't mean that's the only way. And certainly other industries, the CRO position isn't necessarily a requirement. It's key to have a CEO that looks forward, looks ahead, understands bigger picture issues. And this tone of the top issue from a risk perspective makes sense. But many CEOs have also identified the need for someone like a CRO to be there to help guide the business in making better decisions and being able to challenge. The being a part of the business discussion, though, as was mentioned, I think by someone, you have to earn that right. You have to sit there at the table and you have to understand the business issues. Empathy is very important, so it's great to be able to have had some of those experiences yourself, be able to put yourself in their situation to be able to, think about alternative ways of coming up with an answer. It's not just based on details or some specific issue that you might have encountered. It's broad experiences and being able to use those broad experiences at the table to help with the decision making within the organization. So the more you can bring those different perspectives, the challenges that make sense to them once they've started thinking about something from a different direction, the more they'll welcome you at that table.
So we talked about soft skills and consulting skills, key element of getting involved in those discussions. And
oh, clearly, yes. Yeah, there's no question. Again, if you're just a technician, they'll see you that way, and they'll only think of you in that way. And they'll when they have that question, that's when you'll get the call is related to that particular thing. But if they see you as a business partner, then you can bring that much more to the table. So, and from the actuaries in the crowd, as you'd also asked about, how do you become a CRO? My personal experience is that I've had many different kinds of positions within the insurance organization, from product and pricing, valuation. I was an underwriter at one point early in my career, M&A, corporate planning, strategy, CFO. So all those things, to me, gives you that sort of broad perspective that's very important to be able to look across the organization to come up with the issues that matter, not get too mired in the details, be able to do that when you need to, but be able to take that bigger picture view.
Hey, thank you for that. Before we head to the microphones and the SMS questions, that question that I just parked was, how do you measure a risk culture? Maybe we could just go through each person and sort of have a go at that one.
Okay, I'll start. I think you can notice it in the organization when the business starts seeking the input from the risk management function and so on. When instead of the risk management professionals going out to the business and so on, they're being called. They're being called in. It's like, hey, new product proposition. Come and have a look at this. Do you want to come and help us kick the tires? Help us see if it's working, and so on. So I think you see it in demonstrable behaviors within the organization. And the tone from the top bit that we were talking about, which is sort of fundamental, you know, seeing that the right behaviors are being displayed, that you get the right examples set from your senior managers and cascaded down through the organization. That is something that is tangible. You can see that.
Yeah, I think it is very difficult. I think there's, you know, a lot of work going on how you do it. And if you talk with the, you know, various advisors and consultants, have all got different sort of tools. None of them sort of seem to be all-encompassing. I think it's a difficult thing. I think, as I said, the tone from the top is a little bit easier, especially, you know, Challenger is quite a small organisation. It's, you know, what's in the, you know, the senior manager's KPIs. You know, risk's not in there, well, then that sort of sends a bit of a signal. So I think, you know, the senior leadership team, exec team needs to have risk KPIs as part of their performance measurement. You know, with the board's attitude to wanting to talk to the risk professionals separately, whether they want to talk to the CRO, CFO, appointed actuary, general counsel, or without the rest of the management there. And you can do sort of surveys. At Challenger, we do a staff engagement sort of survey once every sort of several years, and we've added a number of risk questions into that. The bit I'm, as I said, I'm interested in getting into is more down into the organisation. You know, the various levels down, you can, as I said, it's really driven by what your immediate manager does. So it all might be very well for the CEO to be talking risk and having the right sense, but if your immediate manager says, oh, don't worry about that rubbish, it's all about sales, then that's the behaviour that you'll respond to. And that's the harder part, I think, to assess and measure. And, you know, I know there's quite a bit of research going on around that. You know, one of the strategies we've used at Challenger is we outsource our internal audit function to one of the major accounting firms, and we've asked them as part of their working through the firm when they're doing doing the various audits is to add some questions around risk culture, and likewise with external audit. You know, we've one of the key requirements we had tended out the external audit function last year. And one of the key requirements we had was what can you do to, you know, help us assess and measure risk culture? Because I think that gets further and deeper into the organisation. You can obviously do sort of large surveys, but if it's a special sort of survey, then, you know, there's concerns around whether people are just telling you what you want to hear and things like that. I think that there are more objective sort of measures, if, you know, incidents and breaches levels and the timeliness of the way those things are rectified, the way people escalate things, whether, you know, there's behaviour of non-escalation and things like that. I think that will sense that you've got a bad risk culture. I think it's, if it's all going well, it's a bit hard to say, to see where it's starting. If there's some rot starting, where it's starting, I think that's the hard part, because I think you sort of know a bad risk culture when you've got it, and a good one when you've got it, but how you got it there and how you change it and how you adapt it, I think that's a hard thing as well.
You just briefly mentioned KPIs. Can you, and you don't have to reveal it if you aren't able to, but any sort of examples of your KPIs that you might use?
Oh, it is really around sort of, and it is a tough one because, you know, at Challenger we like to have a, you know, not shooting the messenger sort of approach to things. So the culture is that, you know, we make errors, and it's a human system, so you've got to expect errors. And that's not something that, you know, gets sort of punished or pushed down. It is really non-escalation of errors or deliberate breaches, you know, behavioural type sort of things around that. That is what will be sanctioned and disciplinary action taken about. But we want, you know, if we make mistakes, we want people to escalate that, because that's how you learn from it. And so it's difficult to say, having your KPIs, that you're not to have more than two high sort of incidents or breaches in a 6-month period or whatever period it is. And so it is, but then again, you can't just have people just randomly making, you know, many errors and thinking that they can confess and that's all okay as well. So, you know, we do have some of those metrics in the KPIs, but as I said, there needs to be some judgment around that as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with your surveys. I mean, we're all probably surveyed out, and you do it as quickly as you can. So,
yeah, I'll make a few words as well. You captured a lot there. On the survey side, we've actually at TEL we do an engagement survey, engagement and values, and we actually kind of hid a few new questions in there this time around related to risk, and we don't have the results yet. So But at least we'll get a benchmark to start to start looking at it going forward. But to me, it is talking about, like you say, compliance issues. It must be about transparency and the willingness to raise those. If I had an organization that didn't have any compliance breaches, I'd be very concerned about that, because that just means they're not telling you about them. This mm-hmm. stuff does happen. In terms of the engagement throughout the organization, that's the difficult journey. I was just at a recent new TAL employee training session. They invited me in to speak a few words, and I asked how many there are risk managers, thinking that that's their position, I guess, and no one raised their hand. So I explained to them that they all were, that that's part of what we do day in, day out. We make decisions with risk in what we're doing. So trying to get them to understand that, you cross a street, you're looking for things around you. Is there a car coming? Whatever, you're assessing the risks there. And the same thing is true when you're working in your day-to-day job. So how you actually measure that is challenging, but it's just a matter of taking the journey over time. And you can't just rely on tone of the top, because that's, one person, that one person could change. It's got to be sustainable. And to do that, it has to be just embedded in the organization.
Is it sort of like also getting culture where you have employees thinking like owners of the business, so that it's their money on the line?
Yeah, no, that is right, because as the first line of defense, they are owning the decisions they're making, the impact that they have on the business in a day-to-day. It could be anyone in the organization. Their role is important. And so if they think of if it's protecting the customers, protecting the brand, whatever it might be, that it's a key element of making the organization successful and helping to do that by having a risk-aware role in the organization.
Yeah. Why?
Yeah, look, I don't think I've got much to add on mm-hmm. on measuring culture. I mean, APRA talked about needing to have a systematic approach to measuring risk culture, and I think a staff survey is about the only way you can objectively do that. You can complement it with a number of other data points, which most of which Richard touched on. I've got a probably slightly different perception on KPIs and how you might embed specific risk measures into performance targets. And I think it comes down to how extensive do you want the list of tasks your leadership teams to focus on? Are there 20 things on it, or are there 5? I think if there are 5, I think you've really got to ask, what are you trying to achieve? Is something focused on risk just thrown in because it's a good thing to do from a compliance perspective? My personal preference is to make everybody accountable for risk and for just part of the behaviours that are expected. And behaviours typically are reflected already in performance management processes. So if you've got a right risk culture and you've got the right focus on behaviours and doing the right thing across the organisation, you may not need risk to be called out. I think the other thing you need to think about is how you want your organisation to function. I'm a POM, so I follow a lot of soccer. I think you've got to decide how do you want to play your soccer. Do you want to score a lot of goals and have a very attacking focus up and down the field?
Yeah.
Or are you happy with your defenders defending and your lone striker, doing what he needs to grind out a 1-0 win? So, I think it's worthwhile thinking, how do you want to play the game? Who are your defenders? Who are your attackers? And how does the whole team come together?
Mm-hmm. Play it with flair, maybe, as well. Could I get anyone from the floor to ask a question? Got the roving mic, and please introduce yourself as well and your organisation. I've got some text questions. Why is the focus on changing risk culture? Shouldn't it be an understanding and then maintaining consistency? Any thoughts on that?
I'll kick off. I think the focus is not on changing risk culture. I think the focus is on embedding risk culture, understanding and maintaining consistency comes after you've embedded that culture in an organization. So I don't believe that the focus is on changing that. It's actually embedding it.
Actually, the third question is related to does the organizational structure help when it comes to funding risk management in Bupa?
The organizational structure helps in deploying the right structures. I don't think that there is a it specifically helps with the funding of risk management. But the structure has a global corporate center with its board, the top company board that has its risk committees and the chief risk officer there, and so on. And then you have five market units across the globe. Those five market units have executive teams and also boards and risk committees, and are run like sort of independent companies. And then within those market units, you have business units. And those business units also have their management structures, risk management, and so on. So your first line of defense sits at those business unit levels, and then the market units help to provide that second line of defense. And then you have an additional layer, which is the top company corporate center.
We've got a couple of questions coming through now. Recently at a senior risk manager's lunch, it was mentioned if you're in a senior risk management role under the age of 35, you shouldn't be, as you have not had enough experience in business to do the role effectively. Would you agree with that?
That's an interesting question. I don't want to have an age bias. but it does make a lot of sense. And just speaking personally from my experiences at age 35, I don't know that I would have been. But I mean, some people are very adept at understanding a broad experience at younger ages. So I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I think sort of that gray hair, the ability to have seen a lot of different things, a lot of experiences, experience things like the GFC in different environments, that does help a lot. So I would say it's more likely to be having the right kinds of experience with age, but not necessarily that it's the only way.
Sure. It's going through different cycles. And right. Having failure, I guess.
I think it depends on the organisation. I guess if you're a smaller organisation and the activities is more focused, then I don't think you need to be as broad. I think that not having the silos does make it a lot harder. You can't be focused on and have skills in market risk alone. You need sort of compliance risk and reputational risk, marketing, other sort of things. So I think that has made it, in some ways it is a hard role in to have someone who's got experience across all the various mm-hmm. aspects of the CRO role. And you need to, potentially need to look at it as more of a team. The CRO is the leader, but as long as if they're a bit weaker in, say, legal risk, if they've got a strong legal compliance, if they've got a strong compliance function, that's fine. Or if they're weaker in market risk, but they've got a very good sort of market risk or, head of credit or something like that, that can sort of cover that. And so I think it's difficult to expect one person to be the expert, subject matter expert in everything. And I think, I do agree that I think just time in the market and sort of life experience does help in managing people and managing sort of, the stress when the markets, turn or when something goes bad. I think that's when you get a little bit tested as to you keep calm and you keep rational around that.
Well, the good news is there's no upper limit then. Do the speakers see the mandatory appointment as an obstacle to expanding their scope within the organisation? Quite often when a role is created for compliance purposes, it is filled for compliance. It sort of automatically removes the CRO from the important list is what this question is.
Yeah, can I comment on that?
Yep.
I mean, I think we're going to be wary of that. I don't think that's where we are right now. If I think about the appointed actuary role, though, I think there's an argument that says we've gone very much down that route, and the role has become less important over time. I'd like to think that that's not going to happen with the CRO role. I think it is a broader role. It's a role that requires a very high level of business engagement. And a good understanding of the organisation. And I guess with the mandatory hard line to the CEO, I think that does mean there's a certain amount of profile and presence that's expected from individuals in those positions. So I think we've got to be wary of that. I don't think that's where we are right now, though. At the end of the day, though, CROs and risk managers are going to need to step up and operate at a higher level.
And that's what I touched on as well early on is, the role was created by the regulator, but then you've got to earn the respect and be part of the business by how you act and work with the business.
it sort of leads to that question that's just come up, is there any guidance on how to strike the right balance between being a trusted advisor and challenging the business?
I'll take that one if you want. I think as you were mentioning before, it's a matter of credibility on the CRO, right? So if you are not challenging the business enough and so on, you lose credibility as a CRO, without a doubt. And in order to become a trusted advisor, you need to have earned that credibility and that place at the table.
Thanks. We've got a question from the floor.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, panel. It's been a really interesting discussion. I'm Elaine Collins, and I'm a non-executive director on the board of Zurich Insurance, and actually we had a day of board meetings yesterday, and it was just seems we had a bit of discussion around our three lines of defence. I think what this session is really telling me, that the first line of defence is managing the risks, frontline people, we understand that. Second line of defence is that monitoring and review, which is very much carried out by the risk management area based on the risk management framework that we have in our company. And third line of defence is assurance, which is internal audit and external audit and so on. So I think what the panel is telling us is really that risk management should move out of that area of monitoring and review to some extent to be at the executive level of business, to be very involved in strategy at the beginning so that when it comes down to their role at second line, they've been more involved. Is that a good summary of where we should be going?
Can I take that? I was chatting to a senior executive within AMP a couple of months ago, and we were talking about the transformation that's occurring in my team at the moment, and talking about the language of the three lines of defence. And he road tested with me how easily the language can be misunderstood. So he ran through this thinking with me. First line's there, first line of defence. They should be managing their risk and capturing issues. And if they don't, second line will capture it. And if they don't, the third line will. Now, I reckon that understanding is 10 years old.
Mm.
And the world has changed significantly. So I think it's great that the regulator is now essentially saying, well, look, there is only one way of doing this well, embedding the good governance, and three lines of defence happens to be what's called a language, though I think is antiquated. I think it is about monitoring and oversight in the second line, but the moment you start hand-holding and helping the business address their issues, then I think you cross a line. I think you've got to leave the first line to manage its risks and to address its issues. Your role is there to be objective.
I disagree to some extent on that one, and I think it is important to monitor and report and so forth. But I also think it's important to get it right up front. You don't want to wait until something is wrong and then measure and say, "Oh, you did that wrong." I mean, to me, it's about working with the business on a proactive and constant basis to really get the decisions being made right in the first place. And then you certainly want to be monitoring and reporting as you go. But there's no question it becomes grayer.
Yeah.
But by reporting to the CEO, you do have some independence anyway from just your stature and where you report. And I think from a regulator standpoint, it would be easier if all we did was monitor and measure, because then they can sort of check that that's what we've done and it's independent and so forth, and you're not involved in the decision. But I think to really add value to the organization, you do kind of need to get involved in that. So that's my perspective on it anyway.
Maybe, Mike, do you want to use some soccer parlay in the description of defence?
No,
I think we've got another question from the floor here.
Greg Martin, Clearview. That was a bit of a segue to my slightly fun question, which was, within the three lines of attack, risk takers, how many risk takers should you have in your risk function to actually stir things up? Because if you want to upside, you don't want defenders.
Interesting.
I don't know if you need risk takers in the sort of risk function, but I certainly think part of the risk appetite sort of statement should be that you are taking risk for a return. And so I don't think you just have downside or limits or restrictions on risk. You do have a requirement to take risk to make the return. And so I think that, you know, and that can be part of the risk departments point out, is that you're, if the, you know, if there's an, if, depends on the organisation, if it's got an aggressive risk appetite and the management is very risk averse, then that needs to be pointed out. They're not going to, and they're not doing what the firm or the objectives the firm want them to do by taking enough risk. And so I think that is the counter to the limits and the control and the like, is that you need to be able to take the risk in a controlled manner, but you do need to take the risk.
And I would say from the second line, it's they're not actually the risk takers because they're not owning those risks. It's within the business. But it's transparency is what's important. So the second line is helping to make sure that whatever those risks are that are being taken are known, identified, measured, and are within the risk appetite. It's all about the transparency. Yeah.
Fundamentally, about organizations understanding clearly what the risk appetite is. And that's always one of the big challenges. So you understand to what extent you want to take risk. And you know, you encourage those risk takers as long as it's fully understood.
Right.
And it's within the boundaries of the organization's appetite. But, you know, as, you know, insurers or banks, whatever it is, you know, taking risk is what we do. That's how we make the money, right?
I mean, Rich, we were talking about this earlier, but, I mean, and Greg, you answered your question. Do we put the sales force into the risk management team? Is that putting attackers in there? Does that ever happen?
Well, sorry, I'll give you an example.
Yep.
Recently, one of my challenges around a project was rather than totally defining, it was an IT project, so it's op risk, but defining it, building it, lots of testers, was going to cost X million, usual 2 years, all those sort of IT project stuff. I said, why are we doing that? Why don't we do a different agile approach? We're going to burn some money along the way, but we'll save on testers, we'll get faster to market, and we'll make more money. I'm still waiting for the answer to that. I think, but that was my, you know, as an aside, people know me. They know I drive sports cars. I always get chipped by my chairman of the board for how can a risk officer run around in a sports car? And I say, well, I like to keep my hand in on what risk looks like. So I like to be up in that space. But anyway, that was a. that I actually think there's a capturing upside.
Yes,
and the challenge part has to be as much kicking people around not being lazy in our industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're about 5 minutes over. We've got morning tea now. Goes till 10:35. We could do one more question, or we'll just take one more, and then we'll close it out. Risk appetite statements hasn't been mentioned, so I'll finish off with this one. How detailed do you think they should be? Should we aim to take a higher level, principles-based approach and stop at setting risk tolerances out of bounds, then allow management to allocate the appetite within operational limits set on policies? Or should the RAS set more granular operational limits?
I'll kick off. I think you have appetite statements at different levels in the organisation. So you have the board sets out the broad statements, and then those are sort of made further made granular at different levels of the organisation, where you do see, you know, your limits and your tolerances, and you have to do that analysis. Fuzzy, too high level risk appetite statements don't really work. Very difficult to measure risk against that appetite statement. So you need a level of granularity. Where possible, you need to try to quantify your risks. So that'll be my view on that.
Okay, thank you. We could just ask everyone to thank our panelists for a fascinating discussion. And I've got a bottle of wine to present, so thank you.